Okay, today is March 14th, and we're going to the philosophy of the Rav. So I wonder if this article from Friday, June 23rd, 1972, again, at the end of June is where the RCA has its convention, so it described this as his annual address. The Rav always addressed the RCA. I was too young to really be part of that when he gave it, but I was old enough to hear some of the addresses of his brother, of Aaron Soloveitchik, at some of these conventions. So it's a very positive headline. Rabbi keeps the law up to date. It's beautiful. Today, a Rosh Yeshiva who at YU, or certainly another yeshiva, that speaks about keeping the law up to date now, would be mocked. Don't you think? Even the way some of YU's own reporters would report something like that. Right? So how did the New York Times, which just loves to bite at us now, what can explain, this will go a long way to feeling what the Rav meant back at that time, 1972. Because by 1972, he was here almost 30 years ago. Okay. Come on, can you come up with something? Explain the New York Times portraying of Soloveitchik in a profoundly positive light, not just with its title, but with maybe the New York Times has changed over time.
So yeah, I can think of two things which are really the opposites of one another. One is that the religious groups were an ally of the New York Times. I mean, they were more friendly towards religion, maybe religious groups were more liberal.
The New York Times, the world has changed drastically since then.
Yeah, the other one is kind of the opposite, which is they kind of see hope in that. They see Judaism becoming more secular.
Okay, so that might be the direction I'll just open to the year. Is that, remember, in 1972, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Baer Soloveitchik was like this, at least as far as the New York Times is concerned, in the rabbinic world, certainly the Orthodox rabbinic world, was seen as something of a trailblazer. It's already in the past that he's been teaching women Talmud, Stern College, right? He has a high school in Boston where boys and girls learn the same thing throughout high school. Right? So the New York Times might feel they always want to stick it to someone, right? But we always have to be careful. Whenever a reporter calls you, be careful. He does not have your best interests in mind. Right? He has a story to tell. He wants to tell it in a way that will sell the most papers. Right? Don't think, this is a good way for me to get my word across. Be careful about what you say. Right? So, I just saw it. I'm teaching about the Rav, so I just thought I'd bring it in and show you. Yeah, I think it's you have the correct assessment, maybe in both ways, but the paper certainly has changed, and maybe the visage of the Rav has changed to some extent. Okay, so I do have the next from here on, especially now we're moving towards Pesach and the end of the semester, what we're doing in the Rav will revolve around his writings on the holidays. We're going to start with Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. Hopefully around Pesach time we'll get up to Pesach, and that'll be a nice segue. And your grade will be determined by the timely submittal of these. And even if you're behind, don't give up hope. Just hand them in. All right. This tests your readings. I didn't give you overly burdensome readings, and hopefully they're enjoyable because they're the Rav's. In the Rav's lifetime, very few works were actually written by him. Most of what you're reading are written by Talmidim. Although what's happening of late is J. just have an exact transcription of shiurim that he gave. I mean, exact. Sometimes you, in the middle of the page it says, the next few words were inaudible. It doesn't try to figure out what it was. It's just an exact transcription.
Is there a difference between that, you know, like their recollection of what he said, or...
I'll tell you this flat out, is that the Rav would tell, I won't say the names of rabbis, but you know, let's say a rabbi who went to Connecticut, who went to a marginally Orthodox congregation, he might say something different, or certain Shiloh, than he would tell you know, someone here in the city. Just like the Rav Paskin differently, let's say in Houston, where the only bakery was owned by a Jew. The only way to get kosher baked goods was for this bakery, which was certainly open on Shabbos. The Rav was very much against buying food from a place that had what's called the Shtar Mechira, where he sells his store on Shabbos to a Gentile, often his wife. And he comes into the store on Shabbos, right? That's his judgment. I just want food that's not made on Shabbos by a Jew. Right? Oh, my wife's making it. No, I sold my store to her. So the Rav was very much against that. But if it's a city where that's the only way to get bread, then fine. But you don't have to do it to ore washers here on the west side when there are other options. Okay? Okay, so in other words, the Rav understood that halacha is not so rigid as to have one exact standard. The same Shiloh could be trade for this woman and kosher for that woman. Right? Okay, this is very well understood. Okay, so that has led to certain sometimes even confusion. Right? Okay, so there will be some questions on those readings as well, and then there will be a final exam. I'll discuss later on what will be covered there, and there will be let's keep it at that for now. We'll talk about any other ways that you can bolster, let's say, late submissions, other things like that, if you wish. Okay? All right, so we are... I'm going to distribute questions on number 5, and just to tell you, do you want to do a question? Some of this is on some theodicy issues. Okay, like a good brisker. The Rav was always very good at showing, well, this is tefillah, this is hazara. This is this type of forgiveness, this is that type of forgiveness. This is this type of tshuva, this is that type of tshuva. Right? This is your kippur tshuva, this is the rest of your tshuva. This is, right? Some of this will dovetail with what we're doing next, which is Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Okay. Wait, Rabbi, when is this due? It says March 14th.
Oh, really? Okay, it should be March 21st. I'm sorry. I wrote this up a week ago. I'm sorry that I should have given it out last week. All right, just March 21st. I'm sorry about that. Okay, this discussion of the 5 for your readings is geared towards the Rav's explanation of mitzvahs. You know, the Sefer Achinuch sort of broke ground by explaining why we do mitzvahs when the Torah seems to avoid such things. Very rarely does the Torah tell us why we're supposed to do things. Like, they didn't say wear tefillin because I took you out of Egypt with a strong hand, so maybe I want to remind myself of Egypt with something other than Shul. Right? How about a big sign that I'll wear on my necklace? Yes, to try it on a necklace. But I don't like Shul. It's a bother. It's expensive. I'm just going to get Zeklitzius to try my own way. Right? Of course, that's cool. You know, that's the danger of That was conservative Judaism. If the shofar is supposed to sound like a woman crying, right? The Gemara says in the second Rosh Hashanah. Why use a shofar? Why not just have a woman crying at the bima? Get an actress, another woman cry at the bima to teach us that we need to bend our will to God, and we need to cry about all our misgivings for our misdeeds for the previous year, and let's learn our lessons. Okay. So the Rav was very much against this type of independence. I want my independence in interpreting the mitzvahs and why we do things. Okay. Right. So the Rav used. I think this might have come up in my Koheles class, but let me just say, Rashi seems to contradict himself about the Paraduma. He insists that there's no explanation of the Paraduma. It defies logic. Don't ask. And then, in the middle of Parshas Chukas, after like 20 seconds of interpretation, he starts the parak over again and explains every single protocol about the Paraduma as a kapara for the egel. So wait a second. The Paraduma does not defy interpretation. It's a kapara for the egel. Every single detail of the Paraduma is explained by Rashi in terms of the Paraduma of the egel. Okay. So the Rav, again, everything is like, you know, if you know your Brisker Torah, this is a din in A, this is a din in B. Okay. The rest of the year, Zechir Tzitzis Mitzrayim is a din in Emunah. The night of Pesach, it goes beyond Emunah to Hodol, Hallel, Zimra, right? Hallel Yirtzah. And the night of Pesach, it's a different deal. Right? Rest of the year, tshuva is this. And Sheni Kippur, tshuva is this. Right? It's a Mishnah in Bava Kama that says if you stole from someone and you give him the money back, you don't have kapara until you ask for forgiveness. I'm sorry that I stole this from you and the pain it caused you. Because you don't have forgiveness for the sins you commit to other people. Wait a second. That's a Mishnah Yuma, isn't it? It's a Mishnah at the end of Yuma. What is this? A Mishnah Baba Kama? Mishnah Yuma says if you ever cause hurt to someone else and you cry out to God in your kippur, you're forgiven for eating your tray for not wearing tzitzis, but you're not forgiven for what you did to someone else. So why is there a Mishnah Baba Kama that teaches me the same thing? Different in how we cause harm to someone else and how we gain forgiveness. Rav was the Brisker is always very good. Rav Chaim, I heard Rav Slavitch's own mouth say, 90% of the Torah spoken out today in all the yeshiva world is taken from my grandfather. Okay. It doesn't have to even be the actual Torah. It's the approach to Torah. Right? What's the reason the Gemara says this, and how does this fit in this circumstance? What's the nafkamina of that circumstance? Okay. All right. So you read in the assignments for number 5 about the the Para Aduma. What makes the Paraduma so difficult to understand is that the Torah commands someone to become Tamei while making someone else Tahor. That's what the Gemara says. Yuma Dakidal. At first, the Rav asks, what's so hard to understand? It's physiologically understandable. Anybody here in med school? No one goes to med school. You know, from here. You can picture that a medical procedure that will help save someone's life, if performed on someone who is well, might harm that person. So what's so hard to understand that what makes you tohar might make me tummy? Right? You need this treatment, and I don't. So the same treatment that helps you become well might make me sick. Why should that be so hard to understand, the Gemara says? or the rabbi on the Gemara. Question.
But it's not that you're making someone tahar that's tahar, it's the person that's making you tahar is going to be tameh, no?
Yeah.
So then it's not the same as doing a procedure on you. It's like, oh, if the doctor does a procedure on you, the doctor now gets your illness.
No, I understand that. But it means that the doctor gives this person this
right.
person.
Right, but he's not receiving the part of he's giving
someone
it.
Someone has to, I can't get a machine to sprinkle the blood, the water on.
Correct, someone has to do it.
That's someone's got to do it. That's where the rub went. Okay, there you go. Yes. That's where the rub went. That the Torah commands, let every man in the world, let every Kohen, or you don't have to be a Kohen to sprinkle the water, by the way. You don't have to be a man in the process. Let everybody on planet Earth say, I'm not doing that. I can't make myself Tommy right now. I've got a bar mitzvah tonight. I'm getting married tonight. I'm not doing this. Get something else. Let everybody in the world make up some excuse, and every Tommy person is going to wallow away in the tumma for the rest of their lives. Because no one wants to fashmetz themselves to help this other person. So the secret of Paraduma is, therefore, that the Torah does expect you to do this. That's an amazing point of Torah. And maybe that's the sin of the power of the ego. Because everybody else watched this small group of Erevrav ruin it. Why didn't you step in and stop them? Get it? This is not the rub. This is just, I said this in my drasha special. Moshe says, Atem chatosem, he says, chato'ol gedola. He feminized the sin, should be chet gedol. Because, maybe today you wouldn't say such a thing, but in the time of the Torah, definitely femininity denoted passivity. That's why the women of Amon Moav can convert immediately. Where it says, because we don't expect the women of Amon and Moab to give us bread and water when we left Egypt, that we have to punish them for not doing it. Oh, you're all with me on this, right? Got it? So Rus is able to join the Kiel immediately. Right? Obviously, Colonial Mummy did not make this cheshbon when he refused. But when Hashem told Shmuel to go to Yishai's house, Rus's great-grandson, to get a king, it's obviously Hashem knows. The women are passive. Don't punish them for not doing what you can't expect them to do in the first place. It's Abraham running out to greet three strangers, not Sarah. He never owed her. That's why they asked where she is. Why isn't she coming out to greet us like everybody else? Because she's in the market? No, she's in the tent. Women don't do this. Right? Everyone clear with me? You with me? Stay with me. Right? So Moshe feminized the sin by saying, you know what? I'm not angry with the guys who worship the ego. They're dead. Right? They're finished. This is why the ego keeps needing kapara every year. Why? Why? Does the Meraglim need kapara every year? Does the Baal Peor need kapara every year? Because the sin of the ego is not on the people who committed the sin. It's on the survivors. Moshe tells them that the 3,000 people were killed. You, the three million people who did nothing, you're the ones that God's angry with. Right? So what can be a kapara for that type of behavior? Forcing people to do that. Okay, now you see the connection. Now, Rashi explains that this doesn't seem to make sense because human nature is to be selfish and to be care about myself. Ah, so I'm commanding you. You did wrong in the ego. Right? Okay, there's another mitzvah in the Torah where the Gemara interprets it this way. It's coming up in the Masechta Sota, in the next Daf Yomi, where we blame the whole community for this one person that was found dead near your city. You know what I'm talking about, right? Also involving Egel, Egla Rufa, and everything the Gemara says about this procedure is meant to show the community that you sat down and you did nothing. Right? Sheep is not at the neck, it's at the back. The animal could never have done work. It's taken to a place that could never have made payros. Because this poor guy, you don't know, maybe he came to your city and asked for lodgings and he wasn't offered. Maybe he asked for food, he wasn't offered. This is unrequited blood and we can't have such a thing in Israel. Here also, by the way, you know, the Torah describes what the Zakenim have to say, we did not spill this blood. The Gemara says, is there Havamina that the elders of this town killed this man? Of course not. ah, yes, you're responsible, because you're responsible that something like this doesn't happen. That's why it's Dafka the Kohen Gadol has to have the people living in the Yer Miklat are praying for them to die. This shouldn't happen with you in charge. Right? So when they say Yodenu, Lo, you have to see it's the way Shofchu is spelled. Any Bakar right here? Yodenu, Lo, Shofchu. That's how it's spelled in the Masorah.
And how should it be pronounced?
Shofchu. Shofchu. The shachu should be like this in the Torah. The Torah doesn't have dots in it. That's how it's played. If you're not prepared with the laning, you might lane. Your denu mo shachu. Okay, so here too, Rosh Hashanah to the Masorah puts in that, hey, to show that the essential sin is that you didn't do what you said. You didn't go against your nature of selfishness to help out this person. The Rav was very big on this, that the mitzvahs are here to refine your character. Yes?
Parshas that go refine on the path.
I'm sorry, what?
Well, parshas that go refine on the path.
I don't know, what are you asking?
Well, parshas that go refine.
It's at the end of Perek Chaf of Devarim, end of Shoftim. You don't believe me? You see what it looks like, okay. Okay, sorry, no, it's perfectly legitimate to always look everything up. Trust and verify. Okay, so it's very good. There's 2 or 3 psukim before the end of Parshas Shoftim. Okay, so that was the Rav's explanation of... you know, there is motivation of mitzvahs, there's interpretation of mitzvahs, but the main thing is the observance of the mitzvah. Okay, this he explained why. You ever hear of a Gemara that says, if someone in the middle of davening says, "Ribono shel Olam, you have such rachamim, you even have rachamim on the birds, al kan tzipor yagiu rachamecha," what are you supposed to say to someone who says that? Shtikin oso. Silence that person. How dare you say that? But wait a second. If you look at the Mefarshim to the Chumash, they all say that. Of course that's why we have Shiluch HaKein to inculcate Rachmonis. That's why we have Osov Eskenov. Of course we can explain mitzvahs. Yes, but the motivation for the mitzvah, it may add to your sense of, yes, I'm accomplishing something. It may add to your the Rav was very much in favor of teaching people the historical background, the archaeological background of mitzvahs. But in the end, it's not your motivation. Motivation is you're an Eved Hashem, right? And an Eved that doesn't have to be asked, well, how does it feel to serve your master? No. Now, again, the Rav was very intellectual and wanted very much for us to, I'll give an example, let's say, bas v'chok, milk and meat. Why do we avoid milk and meat? Because it's a chok. I don't care whether it's hard to digest milk fats and meat fats together at the same time. We shouldn't be eating milk or meat. God didn't want us to, and in the garden he just told us to eat more healthy things. But okay, we need our protein, but don't eat them together. In the ancient world, there's some good studies in the last 100 years, dating back to the 20s, maybe all the way up to the 80s. Of course, whenever you have such a study, there'll always be questions. But the Rambam refers to this in the Mar Avochim a few times, that in the ancient world, milk and meat would be dafka cooked together as part of pagan rituals to show dominance over life and death. Milk is one of the strongest motifs for life in the ancient world. It's the first food that everybody eats. It's maintaining us alive more than anything else. Milk is a motif for life. Meat is dead meat. Elil means meat. So we use the word for dead meat for zara, right, in the ancient world. So milk and meat are cooked together to express a dominance over life and death. The Rambam mentions this in the Bor Devuchim. And again, there were some studies archaeologically that found a stone that said "Tabach Bidi Bachalei Mo," slaughter a kid and cook it in its mother's milk. Again, it was a question of whether this was a forgery, whether it was real. All right, I'm just saying. So, when the Torah says, "You do not dominate life and death," Kadosh Baruch Hu dominates life and death, enhance life, but you cannot undo death. The ancients were simply obsessed with dominating death. They had seances, they would kill a virgin or a new baby and try to communicate with the spirits by drinking the blood of this recently slaughtered person. That's why the Rambam is aware of this also. He said that's why the Torah's prohibition of blood is lo tochlu al hadam, not lo tochlu dam. Lo tochlu al hadam. Don't sit on a seance and drink the blood to try to communicate with the spirits. That's why drinking blood is listed in Parshas Kedoshim together with a whole series of mitzvahs about the occult. Right? The occult, magic and necromancy, that's a seance pulling back your head. And the Torah is very, very serious. Even after all of Parshas Kedoshim mentioned necromancy twice, it ends, I've separated you from my broken nation because I'm holy, and you're holy, we're all holy, and this is what you eat, this is what you don't eat, this is what's coming, this is what's Torah, because you're holy, and I'm holy, therefore, you're holy, therefore, I'm sorry, I'm holy, therefore, you'll be holy. And then it says, the last pasuk says, but if you call back the dead, you'll be dead, to me and Bob. What a downer to end Parshas Kedoshim. Because the very next psukim in Parshas Emor teach that our holy functionaries, i.e. Kohanim, are not supposed to be dead. You get it? Because the ancients were obsessed with death. So the Rav explained, that's why, that's how Torah Aduma comes round full circle. You're not supposed to understand death. Purify it with that which defies human logic. However you use it. Right? It's a chok. Death is a chok. Whether it's because of Gan Eden, whether it's because of Diego, whatever it is, it's all part of a continuum. See how Egla Rufa fits in here? See how Egla Hazav, Paraduma fits in here? I think even Esav, looking at the color red, and he's obsessed with it, he says, pour that food down my throat, I love it, it's red. He goes, and Yaakov says, wait, hold on, Zay just died. I'm cooking these lentils, but I don't care. I'm dying side face death every day in the field. I don't care about the birthright. I'm not even going to outlive death. Right? Asaph sees the color red and sees death. We see the color red and we see we have to make life out of this. Life has to continue. Right? This is all I'm paraphrasing a lot of the Rav's story here, and this relates to question number one on your number five. And it relates to number two as well, actually. This is back to some of the Korach stuff and the why, how, what. In my Shmos book, I have a Musar moment. It says, Bereishis was written very differently than the ancient Near Eastern creation epics. The Sumerian, the Babylonian, the Egyptian, the Akkadian wants to know how the universe was created. You ever read an Akkadian at the creation epic? You read about a Sumerian creation? It's amazing the creativity of how the planets came to be in their descriptions. Amazing creativity. It's absolutely nonsense, but it's amazing creativity. Some of a Sumerian depiction is there's this big bull and this big fish having a cosmic fight. The two of them are the size of galaxies. And they're fighting and kicking in. This is something like this in the Medrash of why we eat fish and meat on the Shabbos, right? About this Medrash, about this ancient epic, right? And they end up killing each other, but not before spitting like one bites off the ear of the other, and he spits it across the cosmos, and the blood that drips out across the cosmos become the plant, right? The blood of that bull is big enough to be Jupiter. Right? Now, of course, it's nonsense, but the ancients actually believed that this is how the planets came to be. Right? The Torah is not interested, this is the question number two now, the Torah is not interested in telling us how the world was created, but
why
the world was created.
So we don't want to why.
Why the world was created so that you can look at the end of the story and say you were created in God's image. And you have a nature about you, and you're supposed to control that nature. And this
we
is
don't
what
see
we're
doing. We see what?
We see, but it's.
If you read into it, you see why.
Read the reading. It's more. When you finish the story of creation, you say, oh, I see.
Doesn't have to
ramifications of it. It's strategic. It changes your particular things. It's a practically focused,
yeah.
Not like curiosity focused.
You know, now they just came up with a tape in Yiddish of the rug saying something, which is a famous joke. I've seen it written up as Purim Torah, even Hanukkah Torah, like a 5-page pamphlet, the Halachos of Christmas Tree. Have you heard it?
Yeah, the Rav.
But the Rav spoke about it 55, 60 years ago in Yiddish. And he said it like a little joke. He said, you know, our main interest is the dry halacha, the mathematical model of the dry halacha. And then he joked, he goes, I guess it was December time, and he jokes and he says, I could just picture if the Christians had such an approach to Christmas tree. They would look, you ever see the way they buy? They just say, okay, I'll take that one. They would spend, they'd take a magnifying glass and look at the green and look at the, oh no, that's not good, there's a little brown there, no good. They'd take out their phone and they'd say, okay, no, too much brown, no, okay. They would spend an hour on each tree and before they, until they go to pick enough.
Oh, there's a county sketch by
just the comedian.
Elon Gould.
I think so.
Yeah, there's that one, right, it's really funny if you want to watch it.
Okay.
By Elon Gould.
All right, So that's the you know, obviously you have to know certain you know, so there's always a time to ask why, how, and what. But the Rav was differentiating in the various times of the mitzvahs as such. And I mean, you know, you can see question number three. I'm asking you actually a question about the Balatanya, because the Rav did have a relationship with Lubavitch, and I actually have a picture of. It was at a bris at my shul in the early 50s. It's a picture of the Rav, the Babacher Rebbe, hardly ever ventured too far out of 1770, and a few other famous Rebbe Rabbanim who was at a bris of an important Balabas at my shul. So they did have a nice relationship, and there's a question, therefore, that because the Rav deals with the Balatanya. You take a look. The Gemara insists that if you read a Gemara 101 times, it's a different type of Eved Hashem than if you read it 100 times. In what way? I mean, after you've been around the corner 65 times, why 101 and 100? I ain't shaman, as we see it. The Gemara in the Sefer Chagiga. There's a Tosfos that tries to bolster up the point with Gematria. Okay, very nice. But, okay. So you have Bar Aduma there also. Let me just close today with some halacha. Okay, I'm just going to talk about the Rav's Torah regarding mincha, the zmanim for mincha, and the zman especially on Erev Shabbos. So you know that the Karbonos, two different opinions, whether Avraham Yitzchok Yaakov set up the Shachas Mincha Maariv, or that they're connected to me. The Gemara concludes that the Avraham Yitzchok Yaakov thing is just like an aspecta, but the main reason why we daven is to connect Shacharis to the Tamid Shal Shachar. Mincha is the Tamid Shal Bein Harbayim. Right? And Maariv is essentially leftover Mincha, known as Hekter Chalavim Ve'Evarim. First mission of the Sefer Brachos mentions this, remember? Okay, so the Zmanim for davening these three, right, will basically mirror the Zmanim of the Korban, right? Gemara in the fourth parak of Brachos makes this point. Okay? Got it? So the Rav quoted the Mechaber and the Ramah. Simon Kof Gimel, Simon Sif Aleph, right at the beginning. Okay. That how much time you have to have mincha depends on how you hold nighttime is. Now you know there's a famous sheet of someone who has a very late nighttime. Rebbeinu Tam, you've heard of him, right? You've heard of that shita, that if you keep Shabbos from Ein Tam, means Shabbos doesn't end until 72 minutes after Shkia. It's 90 minutes after you mentioned left the day before. So if you have a Rabbeinu Tam Mariv, and you extend the day far up, when Rav Soloveitchik's great uncle came to Israel, Brisker Rav, he said that Rav Elul Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe's father brother, he said if Rabbeinu Tam had been in Israel, he wouldn't have held from Rabbeinu Tam. Because as you know, in Israel, very famous Gemara Brachas, Shkia Keherafayim, that the Zman from Shkia till the stars come out in Israel, very much less than here in New York. And it depends on the time of year also. But it gets dark there much faster than it gets dark here. Right? It's different parts of the world. I'm going to see the time from Shkia to Tzeis differently. Alright, Rabbeinu Tam lived in the north of France. So there, of course, from the time of, especially in May, June, July, you need to keep Rabbeinu Tam. I get it. Right? But everyone keeps that, even in places like Israel, they said, but it's too late. The minute is in for so long, you don't change those mentality. All right, let's get back to here. If you keep a late Rabbeinu Tam, so you can daven mincha past Shkia. How much past Shkia? Okay, you daven in a shtiebel. Well, shtiebel on the west side. There's some places I see in the summer in Netanya. You can get a mincha at 10 o'clock at night. At the bells of Beis Medrash.
You can get a shacharis at like 2.
No, it's okay. It's not bells. San is in the time.
Also,
right. So in the San's Beis Medrash, you can get these late minchas late at night. Right. But one thing that is very makbid, they will not let you daven marav until Rabbeinu Tam. They have some rogue minyanim here because it's a stiblach. They have 10 minyanim every minute. But they have some rogue minyanim that meet like outside a little here and they daven marav, you know. Right? Because amongst the Sephardim, in the Sephardim here, they really daven marav nice and early. Right? So and I found that in Breuers, sometimes summer in places where Breuers communities built, they had the minhag to daven marav very early because they started in the 19th century in German shuls to attach the mikveh to the shul. And true, in Rammersville, where we spend the summer, all Breuers goes there, the mikveh is right 15 feet away from the shul, the mikveh entrance. So they want the men finished marav all the way at their home before the women start coming to the mikveh, which is after Tzeis. Right, see, the one daven marav nice, maybe that's one of the reasons why amongst the Sephardim, maybe they also have mikvahs attached to the shuls.
Why not just not attach the mikvahs to the shuls and then you have
it became
to...
It became
as expensive.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to here. The Mishnah Berurah paskins that it's better to daven without a minyan than to daven mincha after Shkia. If your only minyan is for mincha, is after Shkia, daven yourself 5-10 minutes before Shkia. Right? Because
you want to match up with
so that now refers to Machlokas Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda paskins, I'm going to have to continue with this maybe next time, but I'll see. Rabbi Yehuda paskins, that you have to only till Plag HaMincha to daven to bring the korban. And the Chachamim felt until Shkia.
Which one's earlier?
Plag HaMincha is in the summertime, is an hour and a half, close to 2 hours earlier.
And do we have
Plag Minyan, Plag HaMincha Minyanim? That's where you have to daven Mincha before Plag, and as soon as Plag, you can now daven out. Those early Friday night minyanim, not just Friday night. Those early minyanim are Rabbi Yehuda, quote, Rabbi Yehuda plod minyanim. What you shouldn't do is to daven mincha after plod and then marav before Shkia. The Rosh says you shouldn't do that at two different times of the year. I never saw a shul that tries to get mincha before plod in the winter. The beginning of December is like 3:15, 12:00, 1 o'clock mincha.
and then Mario and Shabbat is starting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Not 2, but you don't have to daven Mario before Shkia. But you have to daven Mincha before Shkia. If you're going to daven Mincha
If you're not going to have to plug, you can't wait before she gets to Mario.
You have to do the same thing all year.
Okay.
So if you're davening in a shul that davens early Maariv in the summertime, got it?
You should be doing early.
You have to daven Mincha before Plag in the wintertime.
Oh, we don't hold like that.
Got it? So we don't hold like this rush. But don't do it on the same night. Don't do it on the same night. Once you daven Mincha after Plag, right? You no longer have an early Maariv option tonight. You got me? You understand?
Is it starting at Plag or finishing at Plag?
It's good Tosfos asked that question. Let's say starting at Plag. Okay. So, the Rav's Chiddush was that this Inyan to make sure of davening Mincha on time was for Friday. Have you ever heard of only Friday, not Shabbat. Have you ever heard of a minhag of saying on Friday, good and Erev Shabbos? People ever tell you that?
Yeah.
Good and Erev Shabbos. Good and Erev Shabbos.
The one exception box that hasn't come down.
Right. The loneliness is a tshuva of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and this is part of what motivated the Rav on this topic. He said that once you say good Shabbos, it may be too late for you to daven Mincha.
On Friday, Thursday night.
So this is the Amaratzis.
Yeah.
We can agree that you shouldn't say good Shabbos after you can possibly take in Shabbos. If you say good Shabbos on Friday morning, of course that doesn't make it Shabbos for you.
But after work, you should have a good Shabbos to your coworker.
If it's already after Plaga Mincha, where you could daven Maariv now, right? The Rav used to stand for Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos. Not for the Chadodi. But you ever see some shuls, they stand for the whole Chadodi?
Yeah.
Most places, they just bedafka stand only for the end. They bedafka sit for the Chadodi. So that they can show, I am getting up at the end of the Chadodi, to say, Bowie v'shalom. What am I welcoming when I say those words?
Wasn't that the whole turning around part?
Right, Shabbos, yeah. So that's called a Kabbalah Shabbos. Now let's say you're davening in a shul that has a plag mincha. You're davening mincha at 6:15. Shabbos starts at 7:30, and you're davening mincha at 6:15. Right? And you finish your mincha, and then you start a Kabbalah Shabbos, and you're davening an early Maariv. Right? Okay? When you say Bo'i Chala, Bo'i Chala, this is Shalom Shabbos, it's Shabbos for you. You can't write anymore. You can't. You know, say it's Shabbos for you. Right? Now, if let's say you have a shul with a lot of different minyanim, and someone's coming in to daven mincha at a later minyan, and here's an earlier minyan saying Baruch Hu.
It's not part of that menu.
You shouldn't say Baruch Hu with that. Because on Friday night, Baruch Hu is definitely a Kabbalah Shabbos. The Rav felt that Bo'i Chala is a Kabbalah Shabbos. He's been showing the Shabbos.
Baruch Hu is Shabbos.
Definitely starting Maariv. If you want to say Baruch Hu with them, in your mind, say, I'm not a Kabbalah Shabbos with this. Because once you say Baruch Hu on Friday night, the Rav said, you can no longer without Baruch Hu.
So what's not going to be there? When is it Shabbat and when is it? Not Shabbat.
So
if you're saying
Shabbat comes in, you make an issue whether you daven or not. If you want to make it early,
is it Bo'i Chala or is it
Shabbat? Rav felt that Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos mentions Shabbos. But we were Shalom. What do you think you're accepting? Turning around, Shabbos. That's why the daf can get up for that. But the Rav still remains standing. I'm very mocked on that too. Remains standing for Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos.
So in between Bo'i Chala and Mizmor Shir, can you write or not?
Push comes to shove, I think the Rav would say no. I think the Rav would say no. Because Bo'i Chala means
I want to start with Kabbalah Shabbos, but
not even not the Chul Ramah and not the beginning of the Chul Ramah. The Rav felt that you should recover Shabbos while standing.
What if you stand while you say, so you not say Shabbos Teva? Like, that's obviously Shabbat.
It's a question of what's the stam, what do you... It was also, the Rav had some more Torah on this. The Rav said when a man comes to shul and he comes home to his wife, who benched lecht already, but she doesn't daven maariv, but he daven maariv already. He's already yotzei zechor from a Shabbos kach shalom. He said, Baruch Hashem mekadesh Shabbos. She should make kiddush. She still has the doraisa din of zechor from a Shabbos kach shalom. He's midrabanan. We're going to start with that next time.
Why the Rav felt? Didn't she recall Shabbos by candles?
Ah, maybe. Maybe that's what they're doing.
So, with the 18 minutes.